You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The Bernstein and McKnight Show.
The news is just so devastating for Vanessa and his family. And there's just so many people he touched, you know. And, you know, it's looking at my young players and seeing how emotional they are. They didn't even know him, you know. And it just tells you how far his reach was. So,
Middays on the Score.
That's Doc Rivers on Kobe Bryant. He kept it together for the most part, a very difficult day across the NBA. The Bernstein and McKnight Show here on Sports Radio 670 WSCR, The Score. We are joined now by author Roland Lazenby. You can follow him on Twitter at Lazenby. He is the author of Showboat, The Life of Kobe Bryant. And Roland Lazenby joins us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Roland, always good to talk to you again. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing well. Great to talk to you guys again.
I guess there's no, I don't know what the jumping off point is, but you wrote the book, The Life of Kobe Bryant. How does his death inform your perspective on his life?
Oh, you know, gosh, I'm so numb from it all. I'm still in such a state of disbelief. You know, George Mumford, my dear friend, the guy who was the Zen master for Phil's and Michael's teams there. George, I was just talking to George and, you know, it him, because George was the guy. I introduced Kobe to George, and George flew to Houston to meet him when Kobe was a lost and lonely young player with the Lakers, and that's when George first started talking to him about all the meditation stuff Phil did. And you know, George got that call from TMZ, and he texted me right away, but he told TMZ this is a sick joke. And I guess that sums it up pretty much for me too. This has been just a whole thing of disbelief, and it's personal as well as professional. It's personal. I mean, all the messages that I get from all these people, it's like there's a cop who's a big Kobe fan. He said, "I feel like I lost a family member," and that's, you know, Kobe was a controversial guy. But so many people saw him grow up. No place more so than Chicago. He was a Chicago guy. You know, when he came in, and some of the most glorious garbage time against MJ there. You know, that rocketed him. He wasn't even starting for the Lakers, and the next thing you know, he was starting in the All-Star game. So Chicagoans witnessed a lot of that. It was a charm, but it was all totally misinterpreted, and it was sad.
You know, Roland, I'm going to put you on hold real quick. We're going to try to clean up the phone line and see if we can establish a little bit better sound connection there.
Choppy there.
With the author of Showboat, The Life of Kobe Bryant. Now, that's interesting because I hadn't really thought about the early stages of his career and some of the games that he had here.
Well, you think of his rookie season and how uneven that was. I mean, I don't know that even Kobe thought of it as a good rookie season. It's just so much growth that literal physical growth that he had to go through to get to himself to that second breakout season, his sophomore year.
I think we need to drill down a little bit when he was talking about with people. The man he was just speaking about, George Mumford, mm-hmm. really was the right hand man to Phil Jackson in a lot of ways. That Phil Jackson got a lot of credit for handing out books and being viewed as the Zen master, but George Mumford was the guy where the rubber met the road. Was the guy who would give players some of these ideas and techniques. And Roland, you mentioned that Kobe Bryant was sort of lost and alone at one point before Mumford interceded. Why was he lost and alone?
He was that boy among men. He was light in basketball experience. He played the game his whole life, but he was going into, as you recall, the NBA then was very much a man's game. At the same time, the way he practiced, the take no prisoners approach to everything. Yeah, he was viewed by the older guys on the Lakers as some kid cutting line at the cafeteria. That, according to Rick Fox, explained it to me once. But he put so much pressure on those veterans, and there was just a gulf between them. It was, he ended up there on chutzpah. His parents needed the money. Adidas and Sonny Vaccaro. Sonny spent hours with me going through all of this. They concocted the whole Kobe Bryant stuff. That was Adidas. Kobe had nothing to do with any idea of leaving Charlotte. He had no idea about any of those things developing. The sad moment was he was getting ready to sign this contract. Adidas was paying him millions to turn pro. Sonny Vaccaro explained that he wanted revenge against the NCAA, and he was going to do it by taking the premier college player away, and he'd set out looking for that. He couldn't find kids who would dare go pro then out of high school. And but Kobe's family needed the money, or wanted the money. And Kobe looked at Sonny Vaccaro and said, "Mr. Vaccaro, is there any way I can sign this contract and my parents can have the money and I can go play college basketball?" Now, there are always a lot of mixed signals, but there was this narrative that came out quickly that Kobe was this, you know, spoiled kid. And, he, you know, he had elements of being spoiled, demanding to be a Laker, demanding all this stuff. And it simply wasn't true. Sonny had identified him that as the next Michael Jordan just on a random thing that happened when he was 15, when Kobe was 15. And Sonny explained to me that he let his AAU coach know that. And when you start telling a kid at 15 he's the next Michael Jordan, particularly one who's already stoked to the gills with dreams, well, the whole narrative sort of takes off. The thing that amazed me that I want to emphasize is Kobe could have defended himself at some point in his career and said, "Oh no, all of this is all wrong." He never bothered to say a word. My answer to that is his answer was to outwork everybody, to play, compete, and all questions would be answered in the end. And ultimately, despite his best efforts to destroy his own career, he proved to have the strength to overcome all of that, and he proved to actually get us to the point where, sadly, the questions are answered in the end. But he was so important to basketball culturally, but mostly competitively.
Roland, I think about, you know, just where he was, literally where he was hours before the crash, you know, congratulating LeBron James on passing him in the all-time scoring list in just a mere matter of months. He would have joined Kevin Garnett and Tim Duncan in the Basketball Hall of Fame. It seemed like Kobe Bryant was poised, ready to accept and embrace a next stage of his life with his daughter, who was also on the helicopter with him. And in that is obviously is tragedy.
Oh, it is. One of his friends told me as we were digging down on his early life in Philadelphia, he quoted F. Scott Fitzgerald, "Show me a hero and I'll show you a tragedy." And there are tragic elements, many of them, obviously, when you and your beautiful daughter and the precious lives of other people die in a helicopter crash. It's all about the tragedy. But Kobe Bryant will be remembered for how he lived and competed. And there are people who still hold strong feelings against him over the events of 2003. I understand that. I make no argument against their feelings. They have to interpret those events as they will, but Kobe Bryant had the will to rebuild his life, and I was able to salute that. It's a remarkable thing.
We're talking with Roland Lazenby, the author of Showboat, The Life of Kobe Bryant, and I find it fascinating, too, that concurrently with the events in Colorado and thereafter is when we saw him embrace the persona of the Black Mamba. And I don't know how what the genesis of that was. I don't know how he seized on it. I know it was 2003 were the events. 2004 was when Kill Bill Volume 2 came out, and there's the long monologue about the power of the Black Mamba, the power of the venom, etc. But it seemed, I don't know if dissociative is the word, but embracing a different persona allowed him to compartmentalize maybe Kobe Bryant, the growing person or the healing person, the person understanding something, and the predator, the guy still attacking on the basketball court. What did you see as significant when he adopted that sort of alter ego?
Well, I think that was critical. It's why I ended up, it was the editor's choice ultimately, but it's why I call the book Showboat, that I wrote, the biography, because that was the nickname Shaq gave him. It was disrespectful, but Kobe was the son of Jelly Bean. He was a tremendous showman from the earliest times, and that was a big part of his collision with pro basketball. And yet, with all the damage done to his life, he had to rebuild his narrative around the one thing that did not fail him, and that was his competitive spirit. And I mean at a level that was unmatched. The amount of work, it's just hard to describe those days he put in building this. Obviously, overtraining again and again, doing the kinds of work. I was speaking to a youth group years ago, and this teenage girl in the front row asked me about Kobe. And I said, I asked her what she did. She said, I work at the grocery store, and I'm bagging groceries. And I said, well, when you go in tomorrow, tell all the adults working at the grocery store that you're going to be operating the place in a year and that you're going to own the entire grocery chain in 5 years and that you need all of them to stay after work to study film to figure out how they can do checkout better, how they can restock better, and that you are going to bring an intensity that nobody around you in their right mind wants to embrace. Mm-hmm. And Kobe was that guy. You know, if we could have bottled and sold that, we'd be selling condos on the moon right now as a culture, because he just was the guy out to do the impossible. And he was fearless. He was absolutely fearless. It led to all kinds of things. You know, Chicago is well briefed in the personality type that, you know, the great difficulty of sharing the floor with a Michael Jordan. Now Tex, that was the other big thing, of course, I did. I introduced Tex to Kobe, as I told you, and George Mumford. But Tex always said the difference between Kobe and Michael was that Michael had those 3 years at UNC. And of course, Bill Guthridge, the assistant at UNC, had been Tex's point guard at Kansas State. He had been Texas assistant coach for 8 years. And so Michael, you know, that system at Carolina hit everything. And Michael had had the integrity to compete in that system. And nobody could see what he did there. That's one of the reasons it was such a shock. But Tex had said, if Kobe had even had a year of college, just to learn. Now, Kobe told me he dreamed. I think I told you I was rebounding free throws for him in 99 as the Spurs were sweeping the Lakers. And he told me, you know, out of the blue, he said, I've always dreamed of playing for Tex Winter. And I about fell over. And I got Tex to call him. And it was weird that Tex was still an assistant with the Bulls, and that an assistant for one coach would call the player for another. And, of course, within a couple of months. But Kobe was so lost and lonely, and he wanted to be in that structure. Now, he and Tex would, you know, Tex was his defender. Tex was, Tex had the personality to stand up to Phil Jackson. He had the personality to stand up to Kobe, and Tex was such a pure spirit. And George Mumford factored in there, too. George and Tex both were telling Phil, look, you got to treat this kid differently. You got to relate to him some. Because Phil was just basically shutting Kobe out, wouldn't even meet with him. And this was all through the early days and on. You know, it was a very standoffish thing. Now, coaches, obviously, if you have a guy like Shaq, Phil was so much into establishing hierarchy that, you know, it had to be the Tex. I mean, it had to be the Shaq show. Mm-hmm. That's basketball in that era. Today in analytics, it might have been the Kobe show. We don't know. But Phil made that choice, but he was just so – you know, Phil's tenure was marked not by what he said, but by what he didn't say. And so those were the two people. And I hope I'm not talking over. I have such a schedule. Excuse me just one second. I apologize. I have to go on in L.A. now.
Okay.
It's all right.
No, we could talk all day, Roland, but that was fantastic stuff. We appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to listen.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.